Welcome to the Science Podcast for July 12, 2013. I'm Linda Poon.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. This week, how autonomic nerves contribute to prostate cancer development, the hazards of human-induced earthquakes, and shiny beetles.
Actually, iridescence only arose once in this one group of weevils, and then once it arose, the crystals got elaborated on and it formed all these different kinds.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Tumors are master manipulators. For example, they induce the growth of blood vessels to increase the supply of oxygen and other nutrients in their microenvironment. I spoke with Claire Magnin about a parallel scenario with the supply of autonomic nerve fibers to prostate cancer tumors. Autonomic nerves are involved in involuntary processes like digestion and sweating. Her team found that high densities of certain nerve fibers can help the cancer develop or turn aggressive, and that inhibiting these nerves inhibited the growth and spread of the cancer. She also looked at samples of past cancer patients and found that high levels of these nerves were linked with deadly outcomes.
So what we show in this study is how autonomic nerve fibers infiltrate prostate tumors and contribute to the early stages of cancer development and tumor cell dissemination. So we call this process tumor neurogenesis, as the nerves are newly formed fibers that spread into the tumor mass. This makes an interesting parallel with the process of tumor angiogenesis that was uncovered 40 years ago, for which new vessels are recruited by tumor cells and spread in tumors.
So you're just saying that there's some parallels here between tumor angiogenesis, where blood vessels supply tumors, and you're calling this tumor neurogenesis, where the nerves are supplying something to the tumors that help and support them.
Yeah.
Before the study, you did know a little bit about the fact that nerves are involved in prostate tumors. What was known before your work here?
So about 20 years ago, clinical studies that described the presence of large nerves in the vicinity of prostate tumors, authors called this phenomenon perineural invasion because of the migration of tumor cells along the pre-existing nerves surrounding primary tumors. And the patient who developed perineural invasion had poor clinical outcome, and it's been speculated that tumor cells could leave the primary tumor and disseminate through the invasion of nerves. What we show here seems quite different from the large nerve fibers visible by H&E staining and referred to as perineural invasion.
What kinds of differences did you see between the roles of parasympathetic versus sympathetic nerves?
We uncover distinct functions for both branches of the autonomic nervous system. We show that the sympathetic nerve fibers regulate the early phases of tumor development through the activation of the beta-2 and beta-3 adrenergic receptors that are expressed in the tumor microenvironment. And by contrast, we show that the parasympathetic nervous system promotes prostate cancer dissemination through the activation of the stromal type 1 muscarinic receptor. So actually, sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system exert dual but complementary functions that control cancer behavior.
Okay, so both of these systems have different effects on the prostate cancer in your mouse models, but you also looked at this in human samples. Can you describe what you found in those experiments?
So first of all, I would like to say that it was really interesting to have the opportunity to work on human specimens and a very great enthusiasm to clinically confirm our experiments conducted in mouse models. For this, we had the chance to develop two collaborations with urologists in Durham Medical Center in North Carolina and at Mount Sinai in New York, who provided a cohort of low and high-risk prostate tumors. So what we looked first in the human section is the sympathetic adrenergic nerve fibers and the parasympathetic cholinergic nerve fibers. And we quantified both of them by immunofluorescence and confocal microscopy. The first interesting observation that I've made is that sympathetic nerve fibers were located in the healthy prostate tissue surrounding the tumor and slowly infiltrating the edges of prostate tumors, while the cholinergic fibers, the parasympathetic ones, were restricted to the tumor tissue. We also showed that adrenergic, sympathetic, and cholinergic parasympathetic nerve fibers densities were significantly increased in high-risk tumors compared to low-risk tumors. And finally, high nerve density were significantly correlated with poor clinical outcomes, such as higher PSA levels, extracapsular extension, and biochemical recurrence. So these results suggest that tumor nerve density might be a new marker of prostate cancer aggressiveness.
Oh, I was just going to ask you about that. How might these findings, the presence of these nerve fibers or the buildup of these nerve fibers in people with the more risky form of the cancer, how might that be translated into either a therapy or into a marker?
So our results are consistent with recent epidemiological studies showing that non-selective beta blocker in JAK is associated with improved survival of prostate cancer patients. And for this reason, it would be highly valuable to antagonize beta 2 and beta 3 adrenergic receptors to control tumor initiation and tumor recurrence after surgery and hormonal therapy. And also, adjunction of an antagonist of the type 1 muscarinic receptor may also inhibit tumor invasion and metastasis.
So those are all receptors that appear on these different types of nerves and
trauma cells, not nerves.
Okay.
And nerves act on those receptors.
Now that you've established the role of these nerves in prostate cancer, is this also a possible factor in the progression of other types of cancers?
So far, we focused our work on prostate cancer. However, we've seen nerve fibers in breast cancer sections, suggesting a potential regulation of breast cancer behavior by nerves as well. Mm. But of course, further investigation will be required for any conclusion. So we think that nerves, by making the parallels between nerves and vessels, might potentially affect development and progression of any type of cancer.
Well, Claire Magnan, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you very much, Sarah.
Claire Magnan and colleagues write about the innervation of prostate tumors in this week's issue.
In just 3 years, starting around 2010, the central and eastern portions of the United States experienced over 300 earthquakes. But not all of those earthquakes were Mother Nature's doing. Scientists suspect that many are actually the result of human activities, such as wastewater disposal, hydraulic fracturing, and the construction of large reservoirs. I spoke with seismologist William Ellsworth of the U.S. Geological Survey on the increasing occurrences of injection-induced earthquakes and the consequences they present for the future.
So earthquakes have been happening in some unusual parts of the United States, places where earthquakes are not common, and people have been asking the question, why are these earthquakes occurring? So we've been doing research to look into the cause of these earthquakes and also to ask some questions about what the consequences of these earthquakes or larger earthquakes might be in the future. So in this work, we've been reviewing work that's been done by others recently to look into earthquakes that are now suspected to have been caused by the injection of wastewater into deep underground wells. And we find that some of these earthquakes are large enough that they have the potential for doing damage, and it raises questions about how large such earthquakes might be in the future.
So you call these induced earthquakes, and you mentioned some different reasons, but what are the most common reasons that they happen?
Well, the most common ways that earthquakes can be induced by human activity are through the impoundment of a reservoir, for example, or the construction of underground mines. Those also cause earthquakes, but also very commonly because of the injection of water into deep underground wells. And the process is that by increasing the fluid pressure in the formation, it's possible to destabilize a fault and cause it to slip in the ambient stress field.
Mm-hmm. So right now, you can't really distinguish induced earthquakes from the natural ones using seismological methods alone. But what kind of evidence do we have for earthquakes caused by human activity?
The things that we would look at to try to understand if these earthquakes might be induced is first ask, where did they occur? Are they in unusual places? If so, is it possible that there's an ancient fault that's moving? And if so, why might it be moving? Is there any industrial activity that might be nearby that would be possible as a cause for triggering earthquakes? Of course, earthquakes could be induced in places where earthquakes occur normally, and this complicates the job. So often we have to look at a variety of factors, including the proximity of earthquakes to the perturbation, the size of the effect that's occurring, and also the timing. is there circumstantial evidence that suggests that the earthquakes began at the time of the industrial activity?
You mentioned a lot of different examples in your paper, but you really go into depth into three particular cases, the Rocky Mountain Arsenal, the Rangeley, and the Paradox Valley. What stands out about them?
The Rocky Mountain Arsenal, it was located to the northeast of Denver, Colorado, and it's a place in the early 1960s people began to feel earthquakes, and the question was, why are we having earthquakes in a place that normally does not have them? And investigations showed that these earthquakes were being triggered by the injection of wastewater into a deep underground well. This was the first place that it was possible to demonstrate that human activity through pumping was able to destabilize an ancient fault and cause it to slip. The second case that I discussed is also from Colorado. It's from an oil field in western Colorado, the Rangeley oil field. And this is a place where the United States Geological Survey, in partnership with the field operator, conducted an experiment in earthquake control in the late 1960s and early 1970s. We thought we had a good theory for how injection of water underground could destabilize a fault, and we put that theory to the test at Rangeley. At Rangeley, we were able to show that by elevating the fluid pressure, the rate of earthquakes increased, and when we reduced the fluid pressure beneath a critical value, the earthquake stopped. So it validated what we call the effective stress model. And this is our key to our understanding of how earthquakes can be triggered by fluid injection. What's surprising about Rangeley is that the fault that moved probably had not moved in hundreds of millions of years. And it reminds us that there are stresses in the Earth's crust everywhere, and if a fault is well-oriented in the contemporary stress field, it might move even if it's an ancient fault. The third case that we looked at was from western Colorado, a place that's called Paradox Valley, and this is not related to the petroleum industry. This is a place where salt water is being captured before it can enter the Colorado River system, and the salt water is being injected into a deep well to sequester it. We need to do this because of our treaty obligations with Mexico and to make sure that the water is not saline for all uses downstream, whichever state or country it goes to. And so this is something that's been done for many years now. And as part of that process, small earthquakes are being generated. The operator, the Bureau of Reclamation, monitors the seismicity. They have very careful tracking of what's going on in the well. So this is a very important scientific testbed for us to better understand the process and to get a real handle on the effective stress model. And they really stand out because compared to many other cases where after the fact we found that there are earthquakes associated with an injection well, in these cases we have much better scientific background and data to work with that really help us understand the mechanics of what's happening and allow us to make, I think, useful improvements to our effective stress model going forward.
And then you also mentioned in your paper that there's been this dramatic shift in the frequency rate of earthquakes beginning around 2010, with over 300 earthquakes in just 3 years. Can you explain why that is and if our earthquake detection technology can help us understand what percentage of those earthquakes are actually induced?
We are quite surprised to notice that the rate of earthquake activity in the central and eastern United States had increased so dramatically in just a few years' time. And we now believe that many of these earthquakes, perhaps not all of them, are related to industrial activity, and largely it's wastewater injection. We know that there has been a change in the petroleum industry in terms of the way and places that they are now extracting oil and gas. And in some of these, detailed studies by my colleagues have shown that the earthquakes that are occurring are very likely related to the injection of wastewaters, primarily salty water that can't be put into the surface water system. And while this is a long-used technology for disposing of wastewaters, in some cases, not many, but in some cases, they appear to be triggering earthquakes that are of some concern to people.
Now, most of these earthquakes are minor, with a magnitude of less than 3, and don't really result in structural damages. Despite that, what are the concerns or hazards of induced earthquakes?
Well, there are two things to consider here, and we need to be careful to separate them. The first is the earthquakes that are caused by the industrial process of hydraulic fracturing. This is the technique that's used to unlock the oil and gas that's stored in these tight shale rocks. And this process is one that is controlled very carefully by the operator. They want the fractures that are being produced to stay within the production zone. The earthquakes that are produced as part of this are very small. Most are too small to be felt. A global survey suggests that the largest that's ever been caused by this is only about magnitude 3.5, so not large enough to do structural damage. The same cannot be said for the earthquakes that are being induced by wastewater injection. There's evidence to suggest that an earthquake of magnitude 5.6 that occurred in central Oklahoma in 2011 was induced by wastewater injection. And this earthquake did some damage. It destroyed 14 homes, sent several people to the hospital, and caused millions of dollars of damage. So there is potential for this type of earthquake to do damage if it's in the wrong place.
Mm-hmm. But fracking and wastewater injections are very common practices. What can be done to reduce the risk of man-made earthquake caused by industrial activity?
Well, we have several suggestions as to what might be done. One is we need better information about the wastewater injection process. Scientifically, we would be ahead if we had more information about the volumes of fluid being injected, what pressures they're being injected, and importantly, what the conditions were in the well before injection began. Mm-hmm. These would allow us to apply the effective stress model, the model that we've validated at the Rangeley, Colorado oil field many years ago. The fracking process is one that is monitored very carefully by the industry. They watch the pressures and the volumes very carefully, and in many cases, they actually monitor the small earthquakes, the micro-earthquakes that are occurring during the process. So we have less concern about that. Wastewater is tricky because there are thousands of wells in the United States, over 30,000 wells that are used for wastewater injection, and it appears that only a handful of them are problematic. So there's going to be a need to develop better, more robust, and complete seismic data that would help us spot areas where unusual seismicity may be occurring before it becomes of large magnitude. And in that case, it might be possible to adjust the injection process, perhaps to lower the pressure, to lower the volumes, to decrease the possibility of an earthquake, or in some cases, perhaps terminate injection altogether. These are the kind of things that regulators are going to have to concern. And as scientists, we can help them by developing models that will provide a clear guidance for safe operation of wastewater injection wells.
William Ellsworth, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
William Ellsworth writes about the causes of induced earthquakes and the concerns they pose in this week's Science. You can also find a related news story, report, and Science Express report on human-induced seismicity at www.sciencemag.org.
What gives things color? What makes them shiny? In the case of most animals and plants, color comes from pigments, chemicals that absorb light and reflect back selected wavelengths. When something is iridescent, like peacock feathers, butterflies, and beetles, a different phenomenon is at work. Iridescence is a result of structured coloration. Light is reflected through layered structures or split apart, such that when viewed at different angles, different colors appear. Recently, Elizabeth Panisi attended an evolution meeting and found herself drawn into the mystery of how and why animals have evolved these elaborate color schemes.
I was at the evolution meeting in Utah, and I actually had no interest in beetles. I was just early to a talk, and this woman was putting up slides of these beautifully colored beetles, and I thought, wow, this is pretty interesting. And so I started to listen in, and I was hooked.
Okay, so how do these beetles differ from any other animal or plant's coloration?
So plants and animals make themselves colorful in a variety of ways. Many use pigments, like a cardinal's red feathers, for example, are red because of this pigment called carotenoid, and a larkspur flower is blue because of anthocyanins. But there's also a whole category of colors that arise because of the nature of certain materials in the skin or the scale. And those are called structural colors. And beetles use structural colors to make iridescence.
So what is a photonic crystal?
Okay, so a photonic crystal is just a crystal. A crystal is where you have a regular arrangement of the atoms in a specific network. And a photonic means that this network is able to break up light and reflect back a specific color.
Okay. The researchers not only looked into these structures, but also how they evolved. How did they look into that?
So before this study, researchers knew of a few beetles that had these crystals, these photonic crystals. And these researchers decided to see, well, how widespread are they? And so they looked at the weevils, which is a large group of beetles, and they studied 300 of them, and they looked to see, they took samples of the scales that contained the crystals, and they looked at them with a synchrotron, bombarding them with X-ray radiation so they could actually look at sort of the atomic arrangements of the crystals themselves.
And so what did they see when they looked at that many different types of crystals?
So what they saw was that there are actually many different kinds of crystals. They had known of one kind, and there probably are four or five and combinations of those four or five with different beetles using different ones. And so they were just blown away by this diversity.
Yeah. And so what does it say about the evolution of this property that there is such a high level diversity?
So the initial thought was that these crystals evolved many times because it looked like these beetles were sort of not very closely related to each other. But they then made a family tree of these weevils. They took 64 of them and compared their DNA and sort of linked them together to see who was related to whom. And what they discovered is that actually iridescence only arose once in this one group of weevils. And then once it arose, the crystals got elaborated on and it formed all these different kinds.
So they found out that there's this diversity of crystals, but that all the weevils are related. What are some of the pressures that might have caused this diversification?
Well, it just so happens that the evolution of the photonic crystal called the diamond arrangement coincided with these beetles shifting from living on and eating rotten wood and fungus to eating leaves and living on leaves. And this crystal made them green. So it seems like having the crystal was quite an advantage, and it let the beetles really take advantage of being on plants.
Okay. Well, so one of the most interesting things that you mentioned in the article is something that is yet to be determined, how these crystals actually form on the beetles. Can you talk about some of the speculation there?
So what they noticed was all the different shapes that the crystals come in also are the different shapes that you see when you have structures like liquid crystals self-assemble in a solvent. And so what they think is that it was not very hard for these crystals to evolve because they self-assemble. And they think that what happens is that during the insect's development, membranes inside the cell fold into these crystal shapes, and then chitin, which is a component of the exoskeleton, sort of fills in the gaps there. And so the membranes are acting like a temporary, and the chitin fills in the gaps and becomes the crystal itself.
Very, very cool. So now that we have an inkling of how these beetles are reflecting light and making these colors, how might this be applicable in other areas like material science?
Well, material scientists have long wanted to be able to harness light for using computers. And they don't have a good way of manipulating light, and the beetles show them a way to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. And maybe it could be grown up inside of a beetle or outside of a beetle.
Well, I probably won't grow it up inside of a beetle, but they probably will use the beetle crystals as sort of inspiration for designing their own crystals and maybe even inspiration for how they might make them.
Wow. Okay. Well, Liz Panisi, thanks for talking with me.
Well, thank you.
Elizabeth Panisi is a staff writer for Science. She writes on the evolution of photonic crystals in weevils, as well as on the genetics of animal camouflage and the evolution of the malaria parasite in this week's issue. Finally today, we have David Grimm, online news editor for Science. He's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. So, Dave, first up, we have a story on the timing of pregnancies. We've known for a long time that summer babies are healthier than winter babies, but not the why.
Right. And these are babies that are born in the summer versus those that are born in the winter. There's been this correlation that's been around for a long time. Scientists have seen that children that are born in the winter tend to have more health problems later in life. They tend to be slower growers, have higher incidences of mental illness, and even early death. But it's really been unclear, is that really happening? You know, is that just sort of kind of an old wives' tale, and maybe it's got amplified over time? And if it is happening, why is it happening? And that's what this new study is all about.
So why has it been so difficult to tease out the cause of this or whether or not it's really true?
Well, some studies have shown this correlation between time of birth and problems later in life. The problem is that time of birth, season of birth, month of birth, that's not the only thing going on. There are socioeconomic factors that also play into it. Obviously, mothers that are poorer or have access to fewer resources may also give birth to babies that are less healthy. And researchers have had a hard time separating that from the time of year that the children are born. So what this new study does is actually controls for socioeconomic status by only looking at siblings. So the mother is not changing. Mm-hmm. It's just that the kids are just born at different times of year.
So were they able to see this difference?
Yeah, they actually saw the effect. They saw that babies that were conceived in May especially, and that's babies that are going to be delivered in the winter, were 13% more likely to be born premature. Their gestation time was almost a week below the average. Both of these factors can correlate with things like weaker immune systems, poorer vision and hearing, and slower cognitive development, which could all display later in life. And therefore, you have this link between month of birth and potential health problems.
So they've been able to clinch that and say, here's the correlation, but do they know why? Do they know why when you're born might affect your health?
Well, they don't know why, but they have some speculation. What they saw was another correlation, this time between the time of year that women were delivering and flu season. In fact, when the H1N1 pandemic struck a couple of years ago, it struck about 2 months earlier than usual, than the typical flu season does. And that year, the researchers saw the correlation between birth month and ill health effects also changed by 2 months in that direction. And all this suggests to them that perhaps something about the flu season, is causing mothers to deliver early. And obviously, the earlier that these mothers are delivering, the more health problems the child could have.
So are they going to recommend that people have babies at different times of year?
That's a good question. I mean, the thing to keep in mind is the worst month they saw for having babies was May. And even then, the mothers were only 13% more likely to have babies that were born premature. And prematurity isn't always 100% linked to all these other problems. So you're talking about potentially very small percentages, probably not enough to encourage people to only try to conceive at certain times of the year. But interesting speculation about why this effect might be happening.
Next up, we have another pregnancy story, this one with an autism focus. Autism has become an incredibly common disorder, but researchers are still striving to find a cause. A pair of studies seem to show that maternal antibodies may play a role.
That's right, Sarah. And for a long time, when researchers have been looking at autism, they've been looking at genetic factors. Is there something about mom or dad's DNA that's predisposing their children to autism? These new studies, both performed by the same group, take a different tack. Basically, what they look at is antibodies circulating in the mother's blood. And we already know that antibodies, although they do a lot of good for us, can also do harm. If they turn against our bodies, they can cause autoimmune diseases, things like arthritis and other diseases. And so the question this group had was, might these autoantibodies, as they call them, also play a role in autism?
So what were the clues that this might actually hold?
Well, they found some compelling evidence way back in 2008 when they saw that a quarter of 61 women they looked at that all had autistic children carried an unusual group of antibodies in their blood. And when they did some more studies on these antibodies, when they injected them into pregnant mice, they found that the offspring of these mice had some behavioral problems. You know, it's sort of hard to compare autism in mice and humans, but it suggested that these antibodies were potentially playing a role in the disorder.
So there are two new studies here, one of which focused on the targets of its antibodies. What did they find there?
Well, that study found that these antibodies seem to be having some pretty significant effects on neurons in the brain. They seem to be attacking neurons that were important for memory and learning, for pathways that determine where neurons go in the brain. And that obviously suggests if you have problems with that, you're going to have behavioral problems. The second study, the researchers actually looked at an animal that was much closer to us than mice. They looked at rhesus monkeys. And what they did was they injected some of these antibodies from mothers with autistic children into pregnant rhesus monkeys. And they found that the offspring of these monkeys exhibited some pretty unusual behaviors. First of all, the mothers were overly protective of their infants, suggesting they knew something was wrong with the infants that maybe the scientists weren't picking up on. But there were things that scientists did pick up on. One thing that the monkeys did that was really unusual is they approached unknown animals far more often than their peers did. And this is a really potentially dangerous activity if you're doing that in the wild. It suggests that there's something going wrong behaviorally. Also, the brains of the male monkeys whose mothers had received these injections of antibodies grew larger than those of the females or the controls. And that's actually a pattern that's seen in human babies with autism as well.
So what are the applications for this new information? What can we do with this?
Well, the researchers suggest that we could actually develop a diagnostic test based on this. The idea would be that mothers could be tested to see if they've got these antibodies in their blood. And if they do, they may be very likely to have kids with autism. In fact, the researchers suggest that the test could be as much as 99% accurate, at least for a specific type of autism that affects about a quarter of kids with the condition.
So this is a small sample. Is it going to be that broadly applicable?
Well, yeah, it's a small sample of monkeys. It's only 8 monkeys. And so some of the experts say, you know, you can't really jump the gun and talk about diagnostic tests with such a small sample. It also hasn't been conclusively shown in humans that this test actually would work. So experts are urging caution about how quickly we go from these findings to actually developing a test for autism that may be on the market or at least in your physician's office.
Finally, we have a story on the relationship between malaria and the immune system. Pathogens and parasites need to balance using us with killing us. If they take too much or do too much damage, there goes their home.
Right. And if they don't do enough damage, they can die. So they've got to really walk this fine line. What that suggests is that parasites that have to fight us are going to get stronger. Now, why are they going to fight us? They're going to fight us because we're taking antibiotics, that maybe we've gotten a vaccine, which has sort of ramped up our immune system. And that's indeed what researchers have found, that the more that we try to protect ourselves against these parasites, the more they evolve resistance, the stronger they become, which makes sense from an evolutionary perspective. But this new study suggests that that doesn't always hold true, especially in the case of malaria.
I thought this was a really odd question to ask. They said, what if we put down our arms? Is malaria going to still try to hurt us?
Right. And that's what you would expect. You would say, well, look, we're putting up all these defenses and all these parasites are getting stronger. What if we just throw down our arms? Will the parasites get weaker? And it turns out, no, the parasites actually get stronger. So throwing down your arms is not a good idea. What the researchers did was they actually looked at mice and they basically partially disabled the immune system of these mice. And then they gave them the malaria parasite over the course of several weeks to see how the parasite would fare. And what was surprising is that this parasite actually got a lot stronger, even though the mice had a weak immune system. It was growing faster. It caused more anemia and weight loss. It was just a much nastier parasite than it had been to start out with.
So I still kind of want to know, why did they ask this question? What are the implications of finding out that weakening an immune system makes malaria more of a bad guy?
Well, a lot of people with weakened immune systems live in places where malaria is a real problem. For example, AIDS patients are living longer, yet they still have compromised immune systems. And many live in Africa where malaria is rampant. And one study has already shown that HIV infection has resulted in a 20% increase in the number of malarial parasites, which would be a nice confirmation of the study suggesting that people with weakened immune systems may actually be more susceptible. Parasites may actually be getting stronger in these people. Same thing with, there's a lot of people out there that are taking immunosuppressing drugs or that have autoimmune diseases that could weaken their immune system. So there's potentially a lot of people out there that this could be a real problem for, especially if this parasite is getting stronger despite the fact that we're getting weaker.
Mm-hmm. So is there anything we can do about it?
Well, what it does is if this holds true in people, it really gives physicians this red flag to say, you know, just because you have a population of patients that have weakened immune systems, you can't ignore them or think that malaria is not going to be as harmful on them. You've got to pay as much attention, potentially more attention to them than you would with other patients.
So what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, there's been a lot of press about what's happening in Lake Vostok. This is this Antarctic lake that's buried beneath the ice. Russian scientists have been drilling into it, and there's been a lot of speculation about what is going to be in that water. Is there anything living? One report last week suggests there might even be fish in the lake. We've got a very nice explainer telling you what's true and false about what's really going on in Lake Vostok. Also a story about how sharks stun sardines with slaps of their tail. For Science Insider, we've got a story about what the next Mars rover might look like. Also a story about why the National Science Foundation is doing well despite the sequester that's happening in Washington, D.C. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for Science's online daily news site. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. And that concludes the July 12th, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Linda Poon. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.